So I'm Rick Hansen, and it's, I believe, August 3rd, 2016. And I want to continue on the topic that we've been exploring, which is how to practice with what the Buddha called, or as it's translated, the feeling tone of experience, or in modern language of psychology, it's hedonic tone, the sense of things as being pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Because it's very natural for pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral feelings to arise related to stimuli coming at us from the world outside or bubbling up from the world or inside the world inside. That's very natural. And our ancestors evolved to respond to what was unpleasant by fighting it or fleeing from it or, if you had to, freezing around it. And they evolved to respond to the sense of pleasant by pursuing it, chasing it, trying to eat it, trying to make love with it, what have you. And as far as neutral goes, meh, whatever. And then move on. And also, I think, arguably, there's a fourth significant hedonic tone for us as the most social species on the planet, the sense of things as being heartfelt. They can't just be deconstructed into some, you know, accumulation or arithmetic of pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. So we've been exploring how to let the pleasant be, let the unpleasant be, let the neutral be, let the heartfelt be, responding to it in skillful, useful ways without tipping into the red zone, without tipping into fear or frustration or heartache. And instead, deal with the unpleasant from a core stance of calm strength and peace, dealing with the pleasant from an internal core sense of already satisfied, already contented, and deal with the heartfelt, feeling already loved and loving enough. That's where we're going. Easier said than done, right? And the last week I talked about practicing with fear and anger, with reaction, with the sense of unpleasant that has to do with challenges to safety. An organizing framework that's used commonly in psychology, I use it myself, is this notion that we have three fundamental needs: safety, satisfaction, and connection. There we go. And loosely related to the inner lizard, mouse, and monkey in terms of the evolution of the brain. Safety, satisfaction, connection. Last week, we talked about unpleasant having to do with pain or threat. In other words, challenges to safety. Today I'd like to talk about dealing with the unpleasant having to do with challenges to satisfaction. In other words, how to practice with disappointment or frustration or drivenness, which for me are fairly familiar experiences because I'm pretty engaged, pretty involved in life. The trick is how to dream big dreams, swing for the fences, you know, aspire without getting sucked in to the red zone. So I want to talk about that. Sound relevant? Germane, I guess? Okay, good. So first I want to talk about three things you can do, we can do, I do them myself, when we're in the middle of it. All right? There you are, and all right? What are we going to do? It's unpleasant. We didn't get what we wanted. Right now I'm dealing with some frustration about prepping for this talk I'm giving that I'm traveling to tomorrow. Right now we had some work done on our patio and the very last little bit goofed up. What are we going to do about that now? All right? There's a sense of disappointment. Or maybe it's just taking a long time to achieve some goal. Right? We're goal-directed. Right? We're lean into the future. But it's, we're not getting what we want. Right? Or, you know, as the Buddha pointed out it again and again, you know, pleasures fall away. They end, you know. They're impermanent, right? How do we deal with that? What do we do? So in the moment, the first practice, of course, as always, is to be with what's there. It's unpleasant. It's like this. Oh, there is disappointment. Oh, there is feeling, there are feelings of failure. Oh, there is fear of looking bad because of that failure. Oh, there is irritation around it. Oh, there's a sense of pressure inside. Oh, driving and not yet accomplishing. Why won't anyone help me? Oh, that too. We be with it. First and foremost, we be with it. We feel the feeling. We experience the experience. That's what establishes traction or a solid foundation for any other practices we do. We accept it. We bear it. Hopefully in that, as the Buddha recommended again and again and again, and others have as well, we have insight, not just into the content, like, oh, that's why I'm getting my knickers in a twist here. Oh, that's what happened. I got all into it. Oh, you know, that again, my drivenness for perfection. It's got to be all right. You know, I was the kind of kid in school, they wanted 9 pages, I gave them 18 because they were not going to find fault with me, unlike my parents. So anyway, where was I? So anyway, you're in the middle of it, right? You got to feel it. But in addition to recognizing the content, insight into content, this is the Buddha's radical, one of his radical innovations, is to have insight into the nature of experience itself, into the nature of, if you will, our phenomenology is made up of many parts, fizzing and buzzing away, endlessly, transiently, nothing in it that's actually solid or substantial, no conductor of the symphony inside, no auteur scripting it all out, just unfolding, appearing in a vast, boundless, without a bound or edge, limitless space of awareness. Insight into the nature of things. And through that insight, we cling a bit, little bit less each day, including maybe all the way to complete freedom. So that's the first practice. Be with what's there. It hurts. It sucks. It's like this. It is. Okay. Second practice that I find really useful is to be aware of what else is true. Being aware of the sense of other things that are going okay. Maybe this tile in the mosaic of our life is really disappointing. And also so many other things are okay. You know, putting it in perspective, I heard of practice recently where college students were invited to think about something that was bugging them in terms of how they might feel about it in 10 days or 10 months or 10 years. 10, 10, 10. It's a really good practice. So we put it in perspective, and in particular, we recognize what else is true, right? What else we might take pleasure in. It's not that we're fighting the unpleasant. We're doing what is actually natural to us as animals. We're pulling out of a red zone spike as fast as we can and helping ourselves reset and come back to center. And one of the major pathways into that is through wholesome, rewarding experiences. Drinking a little water, getting a shower, lifting your eyes up and out of the computer screen, you know, looking out, seeing some trees, listening to some music, recognizing the many, many things that are actually going fine in your life, even if this part is just a total disaster. You know, that's a natural way back to a softer landing. That's the second great practice. It's not fighting the unpleasant. We're just helping ourselves in kindness, much like we might try to guide somebody else. Sweetie, I know it's up there too. And also this is true. That's the second practice. And then the third practice, I don't know about you, but often I find that what really helps with frustration and disappointment, once you've kind of regrouped, is to pause and make a plan. Make a plan. Often we're frustrated and disappointed because we didn't properly tend to the causes. Or we were trying to grow roses in a parking lot or corn in the Sahara. We didn't establish, you know, the causes and conditions that would likely bear fruit. Or we were overly optimistic about how well something would go, and we need to recalibrate our expectations, maybe to the point of realizing, you know, this dog will never hunt. This tunnel will never have any cheese. This duck will never fly like an eagle, etc. Okay? So we make a plan. You know, I think that's really important. Planning, good planning, and mobilizing resources in a rational way, in a, you know, reasonable kind of way, can really help us pull out of the frustration or disappointment about this, because we start feeling more reasonably optimistic or resourceful about what we're going to do next. Okay? Suggestions. And then, in terms of how to prevent our reactions in the first place, there too I want to offer three suggestions that have something to do with our own evolved neuropsychology. The first is to watch the inner ad agency. And what I mean by that, and why I'm tapping my head in this strange way, is that if you think about it, a dog, certainly a mouse or lizard, even a big gorilla, is trapped in the present. They don't have much capacity in terms of neural networks to do what's called mental time travel, where they can reflect upon the past and gather lessons from it or obsess about it, right? That's the good news. They don't have that cost. But also trapped in the present, more or less, they can't imagine different scenarios for the future and anticipate or imagine different rewards or penalties associated with those scenarios and then make some wise choices or practice or, rehearse in a sense what they're going to do again and again so that when the situation arises, kaboom, they're going to be able to handle it well. Well, that's a wonderful evolved capacity. As the brain tripled in volume since our ancestors first began using tools to make tools, about 2.5 million years ago, tripled in volume. Arguably, the great majority of that build out has been related to and been driven by the adaptive benefits of two things. One, adaptation to group living, and two, the simulator. Being able to go inside, to go into the past and simulate and recall different events and play it in your mind and, well, I could have done it differently or problematically, woulda, coulda, shoulda, resent, regret, criticize, not so good, right? Or simulate futures of various kinds. But if you watch your own simulator, I call them mini movies. They're these little mini movies. Oh yeah, I ought to do that. And I just immediately, there's like a proliferation of thought. Planning. Well, I could, if I say this, then that'll happen, and if I don't say that, this will happen, or I could say this, then they'll do that, and then I could do this, or, what should I do, right? And what happens then, because basically the way the brain works a lot is around expectation, right? So we run the little mini movie, and then there's a reward, like a carrot dangled in front of us. Oh, yeah, they'll really like me if I say it that way. Oh, yeah, it'll be so cool to have that thing with my friends. Oh, yeah, that'll be the great way to solve that problem. And what's been very striking to me, watching the little mini movies, they usually last only a few seconds, maybe a few dozen seconds. You can watch them unfolding. The rewards promised in them are usually greater than what we actually experience. Oh, it'll be so amazing to have Italian food tonight. And you're there, and it's a restaurant, and it's nice, and conversation's lagging, and the waiter's taking forever to bring the check, and it's okay, that wasn't amazing. Or, oh my, whatever. So watch that. And I think it's because the promise of those rewards is based on subcortical parts of the brain that are really ancient. And if you watch the reward that's promised in the mini movie, it often has a kind of coarse quality to it. It's not very refined. It's sort of exaggerated, like these ads that make us think or feel that we're just going to be so happy if we have that new top from the Gap. We're so happy if we, take Zoloft, and even though they're like droning on with all the side effects, but what you see is all these happy people that are walking down the beach together. Oh yeah, that'll be awesome, right? So to prevent the problem in the first place, watch the inner ad agency. Watch that simulator, mindfulness of the simulator, mindfulness of mini movies. It's like a wonderful tool that can be misused if it goes too far. And check yourself, kind of pull out of them, watch them, pull back from them, okay? The second suggestion about prevention, all right, besides being careful about mini movies and not being, you know, sold by your own simulator, right, is to be really mindful of the internal sense of pressure. Pressure is such a clue that we're starting to slide into the red zone, right? And key distinction, it's one thing to get revved up. You start watching the rev. Like internally, I'm pretty, you know, I'm a fairly calm person, but I can feel that I just tap the gas pedal of my inner Ferrari and whoom, I'm activated, I'm revved. I can go rev really fast. I go whoo. I'm not angry. I'm not, you know, crazy, but I'm I don't know what. I put it up to my Scottish heritage or something. There's some kind of intensity factor. So watch that feeling inside. And it's, I think of revving up as like a yellow flag. As long as it's associated with positive emotion, getting an activation of the sympathetic wing of the nervous system and also related releases of hormones like adrenaline or cortisol, norepinephrine, neurotransmitters when they work in your brain, that's okay. As long as there's positive emotion associated with it, then we're passionate, then we're excited, then we're delighted, we're eager, you know, eager pursuit, right? Or, you know, we're cheering on our kid, or we're revved up to get something done, or like right now I'm getting a little excited talking about it. It's okay. We don't have to be really placid all the time to be spiritual. I mean, like, boring, right? Plus numb. No, but the key is, as soon as we start revving up, even with positive emotion, we're one small step away from getting irritated. You know, have you ever noticed that? You're kind of revved up. It's really going great. Then you get thwarted or an expectation is unfulfilled. What? You know, suddenly like that. And so that's the second suggestion in terms of prevention, tracking that feeling of revving up, getting pressured, getting insistent in your mind. You can track that inner sense of insistence or demand inside. It's got to be like this. There's a feeling of must. You know, think of must as a verb, musting your way through life. That's really a prescription, right, for suffering and maybe harm for others as well. So that's the second suggestion. Watch that, you know, just be careful about that. A little of that can go a long way. And as soon as we are revved up with negative emotion, it's a red flag. Now, maybe we need to do that on a very short-term basis to pull our kids out of a burning building or to just power through a situation. Okay, but it's costly. It's like metal on metal, or it's minimally, it's on, you're into the brake pad when you're in the red zone. And if you hang out there, it starts becoming metal on metal. You know, so try to get out of it as rapidly as possible and prevent that kind of sense of pressure with negative emotion, irritation, anger at others, anger at yourself, negative emotion, fear, you know, that's invaded your core. Be careful about that. Right? Then the last suggestion I have is for me, I don't know, it's one of the cooler things I've kind of discovered or figured out. Plausibly, I'd say, about how the brain works. And it's this. In terms of seeking goals, goal seeking, you know, or reward seeking, there's a place for that. The way it works a lot is that as soon as we establish an expectation, including a standard, like we want to meet a standard, right? The world ought to be like this, right? I ought to be like this. So around that, what happens is that as long as we're meeting that expectation or, you know, or having reality, you know, actual match ideal in terms of a standard, fine, steady dopamine flows. But as soon as there's a gap between expectation and reality, there's a drop of that kind of signal of dopamine, which is associated with dysphoria. It doesn't feel good. It doesn't feel good to have that expectation or standard or goal and have it not be fulfilled. Right? What are we going to do about it? One of the tricks about it is to watch that goal-setting machinery in your mind. Watch that expectation-setting or standard-setting machinery in your mind with associated qualities of insistence in the simulator. And more generally, see if you can find motivation in life more based on a sense of feeling already contented, already satisfied, which draws upon, in terms of, not to be reductionistic, but it does draw upon neurotransmitter systems that have to do with, or neurochemical systems, with the natural opioids or related little peptides. These are dinky little molecules. They're small, and we share them with really, really ancient, not ancient, but simple animals, like oxytocin is one of these little dinky molecules that we share with the animals about a millimeter long that have the smallest nervous system of all, or the least neurons of all, 302, literally, neurons. And those little tiny worms, use oxytocin, which is so heartfelt and loving, and they use that to guide their sexual behavior, all right? So it's a very ancient molecule. And opioids, which are distinct from oxytocin, but they're also really small. These are often released, not in pulses, like dopamine is released mainly in pulses, okay? On, off, you know, right? These are released a lot, not entirely, but a lot, through what's called paracrine transmission, in which they basically ooze out of neurons. They ooze out of the cell bodies, or ooze even out of the axons. They just kind of ooze. What that means then is, instead of it being pulsed, you know, phasic transmission of information, right? Like, oh, disappointment. It's more like they just kind of condition your consciousness altogether. They sort of ooze out into the brain altogether and tend to tilt us, let's say, into a background felt sense of heartfeltness, and we're loved and it's all right and I get it. I went out on a date with you and it didn't go well. Oh well, okay, Cupid, screwed up. Oh well, but I'm really okay. A lot of people love me. I love a lot of people. I'm all right. That's like my background. I'm not in denial about what happened, but it's landing in something. I think about, honestly, take a bowling ball, throw it into a bucket, right? That's an event landing on a brain that doesn't have much background sense of well-being. On the other hand, take that same bowling ball and whoosh, throw it into Lake Tahoe, or better yet, the Pacific Ocean, whoosh, hardly a splash, right? So as we gradually cultivate and repeatedly cultivate authentic contentment, a sense of feeling already satisfied, already enoughness, to me it's very plausible. And it's so hard to run studies on this because they'd be very invasive, so it's just plausible. I'm not trying to say there's some citation for this, but it's very plausible, and it certainly is my own experience, that as we repeatedly rest and look for opportunities to go, it's okay already, you know, already satisfied. It's like meeting the next moment, as the Buddha talked about in the quotation I read in the very beginning, you know, encountering the arising and passing away of experience, like right at that edge of now, arising, vanishing, hanging out here at the tip of the standing wave, you know, of consciousness, right there. If we can enter into that feeling already full, right, again and again and again, then we are moved to engage life and pursue goals and dream big dreams and deal with things not going according to plan or not getting what we want. We can deal with that with a brain and a being that's already kind of saturated with well-being and a sense of fullness and pleasure and happiness. I find that really cool. Think about these little neurons oozing, little opioids like endorphins and other, they're basically, those are molecules related to the experience of enjoyment. And well-being. Okay, so those are my suggestions. I think six of them, right? 3, 4, when you're in the middle of the storm, and 3, 4, how to prevent it in the first place. I offer them. What do you think? Any comments or questions? Great.
I have two things. One is for an individual level. When someone's in like a state of emergency or overwhelm, you know, like they're in the red zone, but they're waka, 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 red zone, you know, really, that you don't have anything left over to make those kind of decisions, you know, like to, you can't relax enough to calm down.
When you're in it, yeah. When you're in it, yeah.
When you're in it, yeah. Yep. So I wondered if you had any tips for dealing with those kind of situations, either for yourself or for, you know, trying to help someone else who's in that situation. And
yeah.
The other thing is, I thought I understood from what you were saying about the discrepancy between your expectation and what is bringing you down, that therefore you should kind of lower your expectations of the world. And that bothers me in terms of wanting social change. Like, I think it's not okay that the world is so unjust.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm so glad you said both those. They're very real, aren't they? And, you know, I think there are a lot of ways to look at it myself. A key thing happened for me when I realized I didn't like feeling that upset. So there's a fundamental question, you know, is there much force inside us when we're in that crummy situation that just doesn't want to feel any worse than we need to feel? And I think that's a big distinction right there. Like, and it has motivated me to be more and more aware of the wear and tear of getting upset on body and mind. And there's a lot of research about that. So, you know, and you don't want to get stressed about being stressed because then you think you'll have a heart attack. It's a version of the line that dogs only attack when they smell fear, right? Which then gets you sucked in like, oh my God, I'm afraid of them smelling fear, around and around it goes. No, so you want to be careful about that. But to realize, wow, I want to pull out of this as fast as I can. I mean, it's okay, you know, a little bit as it goes a long way, but I don't want to stay here. I find that very fairly quickly for me, within seconds, usually there's some kind of little voice starting to talk to me, you know, certainly within minutes, like, wow, do you really want to keep doing this? What do you need to do to get out of it? Rather than, I think, very common for people, they're in it and they just kind of give up about it or they feel the fire. So that's one. Second is to just try to slow it down and or internally recognize I'm doing this to live to see the sunrise. Or I'm doing this, you know, including around social justice because I just have to do this right now. But I'm doing it with my eyes wide open, you know, and I know what I'm doing. And I'm going to try to get out of this as soon as I can. So I think that. I would just say those things. And then about the goals, for me the trick is to have aims, but as soon as we get fixed on, as soon as we thingify our goals, right? As soon as we turn the goal, which is, if you think of it, it's a fuzzy mental representation of what is usually a fuzzy, complicated material phenomenon. So it's kind of like two clouds, a cloud about a cloud. That makes sense so far? We turn them into bricks. You know, like we simplify the world into this thing, and then the representation we form about it is a thing, and then we get driven around that internal representation. Again, what was so powerful about Buddhist psychology is the Buddha brought it into experience. You know, he said, what's your relationship to that experience? It's not so much the world, it's a representation of the world that you're attached to, right? And so, to me, that's a yellow flag. That's a tricky thing. And the trick, of course, is to have goals while also having the wisdom to see, man, that's part of a huge picture. You know, it's just part of a huge picture. It doesn't mean to discount that part, but it's part of a huge picture. And my movement toward it, my contribution to it getting better, is going to be part of a huge picture. Rather than getting fixated, you know, thingified, if you will, I see that a lot. And I think where it also is, if you feel like you're running on empty already because you're so caught up in anger, you know, I think of the bumper sticker, if you're not grouchy, you're not paying attention. You know, if you're not despairing, you're not paying attention. You know, to the extent we're caught up in that, we're going to run out of empty run out of gas pretty soon, you know. Can we come into our commitments, you know, our love for our children, our love for the planet, can we come into that, you know, feeling already full? It's not disloyal to those who truly are empty to fill ourselves up So we have something to offer them over time, down the long road of life, I think. And also, it's important not to be glib about this. I always try to check myself that I'm not just being glib about it, but really feeling it. But I think what I'm saying is true. And I look at people who are much more socially engaged than I am and how they sustain it. And what they all talk about it. If you can't sustain your own personal well-being, it's harder and harder to be of use to other people. Okay. Maybe a few other people? Yeah. That's good, thanks. Wow, great, yeah.
On the first scenario that you mentioned, that when you are in it,
yeah,
and everything is revved up,
yeah,
and you were saying to get out of it as soon as possible. Another thing I was thinking is, like, if you are in it, does that not sometimes helps you to move, you know, because the energy is
right,
going,
right. Yeah.
So using that energy to move.
They're very good points for me, you know, in my view about that, including in a couple ways. The first is, it is true that being revved up in that way, I speak from much personal experience, being driven, determined, you know, I have a saying internally, nothing digs ditches like shovelfuls of dirt. You know, that's me. I'm just a bang away at it kind of guy. Bonk. Wall, bunk, you know what I mean? And so, you know, you can accomplish a lot from that driven place, right? Mm-hmm. And the first question, though, is could I achieve the same goals being less uptight, less righteous, less annoyed with the world, less kind of crazed about it all, less fixated, less grinding away at it till I'm exhausted? Could I actually accomplish the same result not through stressing myself out? And I think often you'll find these people, and you see them a lot in the culture these days. It's really interesting. I think of them as professional Grinches, you know? People who are, fancy word, valorizing. People who are really validating and privileging and praising a kind of crazy drivenness. You'll see this in companies, you know, they'll yap about their well-being program. Yeah, right. But really, they're very happy to exploit people, willing to work 60 hours a week and promote subtly through commission, acts of commission and omission, you know, to perpetuate that kind of culture where you're all part of the team and warrior and boom, 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 you know? And I'm like, yeah, who benefits from this? And other ways, so I would say that. But then the other thing, I would definitely say, and I've seen this with people, a version of this is I would rather have a client who is angry than one who is depressed. And sometimes I think, as a transitional step, as an intermediate vehicle, especially if you're a person who, in your own individual life, or maybe because you belong to a class of people that have been kind of thumbed down, you know, it can help actually as an intermediate vehicle to access a certain sense of outrage and fieriness and basta, you know. I have so had it. I'm sorry, making rude gestures here. You know, it's not where you want to, like, you don't want to hang out there on your deathbed. You know what I mean? You want to eventually work your way out of it. It's not a prescription for the full of life, but it can be an intermediate vehicle. And including being suspicious of or skeptical about people who are trying to talk you out of that, who take advantage of quiescence or feeling small, or, please, sir, may I have another bowl of oatmeal? You know, Oliver Twist and all. You know what I mean? So those are two reflections. Did you want to add more to that? Yeah. All right, I'm glad you brought that up too. You're like hitting all the major objections. It's really good. It's really good. So, right, you all heard that? So it's this idea that, you know, if we feel completely content and hunky-dory inside, we won't fill in the blank. You know, repair the fence, write that poem, you know, do that project, right? Like, Right? And I think that's a very interesting question. So what? Like, here's a question. When you are in that mode and you're just super happy, what happens? Hours go by? Days go by, right? But fairly soon, my observation, most people start moving into some form of productive engagement with life, some form of helping others, you know? Some form of contribution, one kind or other. Some form of, like, they have a dream that can now come forward because they're not so stressed out. It actually has room to sort of bubble up into consciousness. You know, I want to go back to the piano. You know, I want to paint again. You know, I'd always like to learn how to cook a little better. I'm going to try that or something like that. You know, I'm going to start reading those books. That's, I find, really natural for people. And actually, my observation, and this is a version of A.S. Neill's observation about Summerhill. Do you know Summerhill is the first original free school in England? He was quite a character, A.S. Neill. And so that school, it was literally a free school. You may know about it. Summerhill, been a model for other schools. They did not make the kids do anything, which in England, I don't know when they started it, the 30s, the 40s. That was like a total heresy, maybe, I don't know, 50s or 60s, something, okay? So, but what Neill noticed is that no kid ever did nothing for 2 years, for just indefinitely. The record was a 2 year. This kid held out for 2 years. But in general, you know, and this is, I don't know what, high school through high school, okay? Maybe starting younger, I forget. But in, what he noted, what he said, which I'm going to offer as a thought here, is that there was a loose correlation, though, between how long the kid, or perhaps the adult, just sort of sat on their thumbs, you know, twiddled their thumbs, just blah. Direct relationship between how long they were sort of inert, you know, and how stressed out they had been before. So actually, maybe what we need to do is when we feel completely fine and all right, we're just recovering from the gradual accumulated load of weeks and years, really, of accumulated stress. And maybe that's what it's really telling us. And if we lived more from that place of contentment, we would, you know, step into more quickly. You know, let's do something fun. You know, what can we do here? How can I help the world be better? My heart is drawn, tugged by others. Or I always wanted to express myself in some way. And see, I think, run the experiment. Yeah, see if that's true for you. Yeah, last person.
I was just, not really a question, but I was just looking at a meta-analysis of creativity.
Uh-huh.
And it was saying that it's actually related to positive mood, positive affect more, when people are feeling good,
yeah.
Full.
Yeah.
Because there is, of course, the whole coming out of, you know, creativity coming out of...
Yeah, tortured artists. Bipolar, don't forget that one.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. But overall, kind of the general is when people are feeling full, when the creativity starts.
Yeah. Maybe that's a nice place to finish, just a segue to, of course, Abraham Maslow and self-actualization. What I mean by that is, you know, Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right? Kind of a loose hierarchy. What's interesting is that the first four needs, he called them D needs. D for deficiency. Something is missing. There's not enough safety or not enough power or not enough connection or not enough status of some kind. Something is missing. And then self-actualization, though, the fifth level in this loose hierarchy, is called a be need, a being need. We are already full. Isn't that interesting? And I think that's kind of the question. You can go after the same goal. You can write the same email, you know, pull together the same book proposal, tell someone the way it's got to be, whatever. Ask, you know, someone out on a date, whatever. We can, or say no to someone who wants you to go out on a date, whatever. We can do those things, but the question is, where do we come from? You know, do we enter into that next moment that the Buddha talked about from a place of not enoughness and irritability and frustration and demand that the world be a certain way? Or do we enter that moment with all those gushy opioids awash in the soup like a lovely curcumin or curry or mint or oregano in the sauce of the neuro soup we marinate in, you know, entering the next moment, including in our heart, feeling that kind of contentment. That's really sort of the question. The Buddha didn't stop teaching. He didn't stop doing his thing. And there were people who were very engaged in the world who, according to the teachings, became fully awakened. It's not about engagement or non-engagement. It's about on what basis do we engage goals and dream big dreams and deal with life. How about we sit for a minute and marinate in this, and then we'll wrap up. Actually, as we sit here, I'll offer a quote that I brought. He says, "When faced with the vicissitudes of life, one's mind should remain unshaken, sorrowless, stainless, secure. This is the greatest welfare." There are vicissitudes. How do we meet them? He also says, "The fever of passion exists not for one who has completed the journey." The fever, the red zone, the heat, does not exist for one who has completed the journey, who is sorrowless and wholly set free, and has broken all ties to the next moment of experience. Love is still real, connection is still real, but there's not a demandingness or a clinging to in the mind. Well, see you next Wednesday, I hope.
I'll save the Donna for you.
Thank you. You read my mind. Thank you.